Your trusted source for news and analysis about Chicago White Sox prospects and player development, covering the Major League Baseball draft and international market, plus the action in Kannapolis, Winston-Salem, Birmingham, and Charlotte. This is the Future Sox Podcast with your hosts, Mike Rankin and James Fox.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Future Sox Podcast. My name's Mike Rankin. Good to be with you again. James Fox alongside us. He's our senior editor over at Future Sox, now part of SoxMachine.com. If you haven't heard, check us out at SoxMachine.com/Future Sox. We are now part of that platform and also part of the Blue Wire Network. So if you subscribe to our podcast, you will see us weekly on Tuesdays right there for you, nice, safe, and sound. So if you enjoy the content, we appreciate your support. Continue to be with us throughout the Major League Baseball season and throughout the offseason. We cover everything minor league baseball. And now, since we're attached to Sox Machine, James, we get to focus a little bit more on the Major League club. And we do hit on that in the interview upcoming with Jim Callis. So we really are excited for the listener, yourself, to hear what he has to say. A ton of great insight coming up. But how fun is that, James? We can not necessarily be restricted to Future Sox and the minor leagues here in the organization, but just to be able to branch out, allow yourself to have thoughts on the big league club without any restrictions. It's kind of nice, I'll be honest.
Yeah, it's been fun so far. Obviously, you know, I did big league content sometimes, you know, somewhere else, obviously, but having it all kind of linked together and the synergy here has been great. We got a ton of content on the site. There's been some interesting minor league performances to start the year. You know, I've mentioned this before, but you know, I don't think we disagree with the 30th ranked prospect ranking, right? I mean, I think they got there and everybody talks about how they got there for the right reasons, and whether you believe that or not, like, that's fine. But I feel like there's prospects that I'm following every night in a 30th ranked system. It's just, you know, it's kind of weird to me. It's just, you know, it's, I kind of reference, like, you know, the White Sox have been 30 before with a guy like Addison Reed as their main prospect. And you know, this time they might have two or three guys that end up in the top 100 by the end of the year.
And we'll get into a little bit with Jim Callis, the senior writer at MLB.com for Major League Baseball Pipeline, covers prospects across the country. When you talk about that specifically, like Luis Mieses is standing out, Brian Ramos is a walking highlight reel, and Jose Rodriguez is standing out as a highly touted prospect, struggling a little bit in Birmingham. We'll get to that, but these are names, like you said, it's not necessarily this is a bunch of guys in the top in the 30th ranked system in Major League Baseball. There are highlighted players scattered across the White Sox top 30 that could elevate this group to, you know, in the lower third there, at the top end of the lower third there, sooner rather than later. I know you're going to get into the draft conversation a little bit late in the interview with Jim Callis, and that hopefully will again make this organization take the next step in terms of how evaluators perceive them. But that's what we're excited about, James, is highlighting specific players that are on the top end of this 30th ranked system. Guys like Colson Montgomery and Wes Kath, and then even those who are fans, I should say, are unfamiliar with those types of names. I mean, these are fun times to get involved in finding out what the White Sox really do have organizationally. I think it's an interesting kind of thought to have, is how do you evaluate the White Sox in terms of going after pitching prospects or building their depth the way they are internally? The draft, I know we're a few months away from the draft, but this is a topic of conversation already because it is telling as to how Mike Shirley and the rest of the organization is trying to structure this team moving forward.
Yeah, and you know, like we were talked about content earlier, me and Josh, you know, put our first mock draft up on the site. You know, that's one other positive, you know, of working with those guys is Josh consumes a lot of college baseball, whereas I mostly catch up late, I feel like closer to the start of the draft and do, you know, a lot more of my research then. He's seen a lot of these players. So, you know, nobody will be shocked to know that I projected a high school center fielder and Josh put a college pitcher. So you'll have to go to the site to read that. You know, one last thing, you mentioned the pitching development. I think it's lacking. I think we're going to, you know, it's going to be a point of conversation all year. I think the White Sox know that maybe some changes are in order with how they've been developing pitchers. But I will say, Like, I'm interested to dig in as the year goes on the developmental side for hitters on the offensive side, because like you've mentioned some names, some under the radar names, there's lots of guys producing right now. And, you know, their new hitting coordinator in the minor leagues is a guy by the name of Andy Barquette. You know, he was in Pittsburgh for a while. He was in Boston with Tony as the assistant hitting coach in the majors. So, you know, I don't know how much he has to do with it, but it's definitely something I'm going to dig into. They have a new biomechanics analyst, and, you know, the guys are hitting really well at Winston-Salem. That's where Nicky Delmonico is the hitting coach this year. So, you know, these are just like some, you know, tertiary stories, I guess, that I'm going to keep my eye on, because, you know, the offensive display early on in this minor league season has been interesting.
Sounds like a feature story, if you ask me, and I'm just saying, but that's why we have you, James. You're on it. So that's James Fox. My name's Mike Rankin. Again, thanks so much for tuning into this episode of the Future Sox Podcast, now part of the Blue Wire Network and also part of SoxMachine.com. We have Jim Callis joining us again. I'm biased. Man, this is a good interview. He provides a ton of insight on the organization. So stick with us. We're going to take a break. When we come back, it's Jim Callis of MLB Pipeline joining us on the Future Sox Podcast. It's great to be joined again by Jim Callis at Jim Callis MLB on Twitter. He is the senior writer for MLB Pipeline on MLB.com, and he is an expert on Major League Baseball prospects across all of Major League Baseball, and it's wonderful to talk to him specifically about the White Sox selfishly because, well, we really enjoy his work and we take advantage of it. With that being said, Jim, welcome back.
Thanks.
First of all, it's always great to talk to you. I want to start the conversation with this because it intrigued me going into this season. Yeah, I expected at least some verbiage to come out regarding service time manipulation or the significance of prospects in the big leagues. You know, a lot of the time we consider the younger prospects or those who are, you know, 22 years old, 23 years old in the big leagues the currency of the game these days. And it seems like, you know, I don't know if it's a record number, but there's a lot of top prospects who made the opening day roster to begin this season. You know, guys like Hunter Green and Jeremy Pena and Julio Rodriguez, just to name a few, Spencer Torkelson in the American League Central. Is there anything outside of just them being ready to play in the big leagues that has organizations these days motivated to bring them up right away?
I think there's a number of things. I mean, one, I think this is a really talented class. I mean, you know, we had, and we went back and looked, and we couldn't find a case where three of our top five prospects going into a season at MLB.com, you know, with Bobby Witt Jr. and Julio Rodriguez and Spencer Torkelson, all debuted in the big leagues on opening day. And it would have maybe been 5-for-5 if Adley Rutschman and Riley Green hadn't been hurt. So I think that was unusual for one. I know, you know, I think people have been trying to credit like, oh, this new rule where if you have the rookie eligible player who's on a preseason, you know, multiple preseason top 100 prospects rankings, I think by us and Baseball America and ESPN, and they get a full year service time, they finish, what is it, first or second in rookie of the year voting or top three in MVP or Cy Young Award voting before they're eligible for arbitration, you can get extra picks in the draft. So I know, like, I think, you know, the people would like to say, oh, like, hey, the new CBA, it's working great. I you know, maybe that played part of it, but I think, like, the other thing is too, I think a lot of these young guys who are up right now are on teams that are trying to win or at least feel like they have a shot to contend going into the year. And I think the expanded playoffs played a part in that. But, you know, like with Bobby Witt Jr., and we could debate, like, are the Royals really going to contend? I mean, I think if they're, like, young pitching came through, they might. Yeah, they probably aren't. They're like the Tigers. They're kind of a borderline contender depending on what their young pitching does. But, like, I think Dayton Moore has always been about doing what's right for the game. And if Bobby Witt Jr. deserved to make the team, they were never going to manipulate him. And I think the Mariners, who just missed the playoffs last year, are trying to contend. So, like, it was a no-brainer to call up Julio Rodriguez. And I think the Tigers, you know, like I said, if their young pitching comes through, although, you know, as we record this, Casey Mize has just gone on the DL. You know, I think that's why they call up Torkelson. And, you know, the Reds weren't too far off last year. And although they got rid of a lot of their pitchers, they have a lot of good young pitchers up. So I think that's why Hunter Green's up. So I think it's just kind of a perfect storm where you have some really great prospects. You have teams that are trying to win in a more expanded playoff field. I do think the potential for having an extra pick if you don't try to manipulate helps too. And I also think that, you know, maybe part of the reason we have so many guys kind of coming up at once is I think that, you know, not having a season in 2020 kind of slowed down some guys who might have already been up. Like, you can argue if Julio Rodriguez had a full season in 2020, maybe he's up last year. You know, maybe Bobby Witt's up last year. You know, maybe, you know, maybe not Torkelson because he was drafted in 2020, but we might have seen some of these guys in advance. So I think it's a variety of all those factors, honestly.
So, you know, Jim, the White Sox farm system is obviously, you know, it's been at the bottom pretty much for everybody's rankings. No argument from us, but it's weird for a 30th ranked system. There's like a lot of guys that I've been following early on, you know, starting with their first rounder last year, Colson Montgomery. Was there any debate for you about him being the number one prospect in this system? And then, you know, he's kind of walked a ton and he's in low A obviously, but anything about that and his decent start so far surprising to you?
Yeah, I mean, they are ranked 30th, but like I always tell people, the rankings are very cyclical. And it was only a couple of years ago. Like, I know they were number one on our list. I mean, that was probably maybe 4 or 5 years ago. But they've been a consistent top five, top 10 farm system. And they basically did their job. They graduated everybody to the big leagues. And all these, you know, so, I mean, if you look at the big league club, it's a lot of guys who've come through the system. And obviously, it's a very good big league club. And it's hard, you know, once you start to win, you get fewer draft picks and less bonus pool money and, you know, less international pool money. And you're not trading Chris Sale or Adam Eaton for prospects. You're trading prospects for players. So, I don't think, and not that you guys were saying it was either, I don't think them being 30th is an indictment. I think it's more just kind of a statement of where they are in the cycle. I mean, yeah, I mean, you wish it was better, but, you know, I don't think, I mean, you guys are White Sox fans. Do you have any complaints about the big league team right now? Now, I know you guys weren't saying this, but I know like sometimes like we'll get like, oh, how could you rank, like somebody will say like, how could you rank our system so poorly? Like, or what does that say? Like, they're doing a bad job. And I don't think the White Sox are doing a bad job, but beginning to, you know, like I said, it's just cyclical. But getting to Colson Montgomery, I think the only other guy you could debate having number one going into the year might've been Oscar Colas. And you just get such a wide range of performance on the Cubans when they make their debuts that I tend to wait and see how they perform, I guess, a little bit. Like, I mean, if somebody wanted to argue Oscar Colas number one, I'd say sure. Cause you could argue that he might have a higher ceiling than Colson, higher offensive ceiling than Colson Montgomery. Like, you could, I think you could argue that, but I do think Colson's 3 years younger. Not that either one of them played a whole lot, but he's an infielder. Colas is an outfielder. Colas, you know, probably a right fielder. When all is said and done, you know, we'll see on Montgomery, but you know, he might be able to stay at shortstop. I mean, he's bigger, but he's pretty athletic. So I think you've got the potential for significantly more defensive value from Colson. So I didn't really debate about it too much. I mean, how about you guys? I mean, who do you guys have number one on your list, and how close was it?
So we have Montgomery one. It was hard with Oscar Colas, obviously, like you've said. I mean, I know Jesse Sanchez does that for you guys, and then, you know, it's just like tough to rank. So we had him up there. Like, we really like Jorge Vera a lot too, but he's sidelined again right now and hasn't pitched, and he's probably not going to pitch till June. So, you know, those were our top three. I think we were pretty much in lockstep, like just having Colson Montgomery there. So I'm kind of excited to see how he started.
Yeah. And he's off to, I mean, it's, yeah. And you guys had asked about that too. And I was gonna say, like sometimes you'll have people make an argument like, oh, Oscar Colas hasn't played yet, and Colson Montgomery only played a little bit in rookie ball. And even like Jorge Vera was only in the DSL. So like, sometimes you'll have people say, you got to give it to a guy who's played a little bit, which I don't agree with. Cause I think you're looking at, you know, long-term value. And just because Oscar Colas hasn't played in a game doesn't diminish his long-term value. You just have to project what it is. So it's like, if you're going on guys who had played full season ball, I guess my guy might have been Jose Rodriguez. But again, I think you're looking at long-term value, so I have to do that. Like with Colson, I mean, it's early. I mean, he's played, I think, as we record this, 33 professional games, you know, 7 in low A. But you mentioned, you guys mentioned the walks. And I do think that's promising. Like, I don't care too much. Like, especially debut summer stats, I don't worry about too much unless they're bad. Then like, I think there's a little cause for question. But I think the most encouraging thing about Colson, you know, not so much the raw numbers, is just that, like you noted, I mean, he's controlling the strike zone really well. Like, he's drawn a really healthy amount of walks. And, like, you just honestly, I don't think have any idea. I mean, obviously teams have to do this when they're drafting guys. And we try to do it when, you know, all of us are analyzing prospects. But when you're taking these guys from, especially like high school ball into pro ball, you don't really have any idea how they're going to manage the strike zone. You might be able to look at some data from showcases, like, oh, here's 20 at bats we got, you know, or 40 at bats we got at showcases, but you don't know exactly what's going on there. So to me, the most encouraging part for Colson is that he has shown like really good patience at the plate. And I think, I mean, again, it's small sample sizes. You could argue, you know, in rookie ball, it's not like sometimes, you know, drawing walks isn't indicative of like, oh, he's got a great eye. It may just be, hey, he's a first round pick and they're pitching around him and pitching around a guy in rookie ball. They're not pitching 3 inches off the plate. It's like a foot off the, you know, plate, and it's easier to discern. But he's walking again this year, and I think that's a very, very promising sign. And also, in an odd sort of way, like, I mean, look, I mean, he's probably going to be, I think he's going to hit for average in power, but just because of his size, you know, I think he'll probably be a little bit more power than hit. And even though he doesn't have a home run, like, in a weird sort of way, he's got 10 doubles, which is a super healthy amount of doubles. I mean, again, you'd like to see home runs. This is going to sound stupid. I almost look at that as like almost an encouraging sign. Like, he hasn't come into pro ball swinging for the fences, trying to show everybody he's a first round pick and he's got power. I think he's just coming to pro ball and just looks very natural at the plate instead of trying to sell out and force things. So that's been my biggest takeaway from him so far.
Yeah, right there just goes inside the mind of evaluating prospects like that in terms of creating rankings and expectations. I mean, that is wonderful insight, Jim. Let me take you to this, because you brought up the Big League Club as well as Oscar Colas. If you could put yourself in the shoes of the organization in the GM's office, and this offseason, the White Sox fan base was, you know, they were really excited about expectations this year. And, you know, they did go out and make a trade for AJ Pollock, and he's under control for 2 years now. And they decided against signing a free agent outfielder to a long-term contract. And they, you know what, they haven't done that over the last five seasons. So with that being said, related to what they have in the farm system, Oscar Colas, Yoelki Cespedes, as well as what they have depth-wise in the big leagues at Luis Robert. And as well, you can consider Andrew Vaughn. You know, Jose Abreu is getting older at first base, and Andrew Vaughn, at least the expectations here, is he could be the future at first base. Do you think the depth within the system regarding Oscar Colas and their confidence in Cespedes had them a little reluctant to going out and signing a long-term piece in the outfield, or is it just a matter of their philosophy saying we want to have as much flexibility as possible and not tying ourselves down long-term to one player?
I think it was probably both. I mean, I think if, like, you know, I don't know that they've really ever, you know, they haven't ever given out one of those, like, $300 million contracts, you know, to, like, a superstar. Like, if Aaron Judge becomes a free agent, I don't even know that they'd go out and, you know, and try to get him. I mean, I know they tried to sign Machado, but you know, I think it's some of both, because, like you can never have too much talent. But you could kind of even look at the White Sox now, and it's hard to kind of squeeze everybody in to the lineup. You know, as long as Abreu remains productive, you know, Andrew Vaughn's really not an outfielder. Like, so Andrew Vaughn's, you know, your DH. And, you know, you've got, you know, I think Eloy Jimenez is going to be a star. I think Luis Robert's going to be a star. So there's two of your outfield spots. I mean, you can debate about Eloy, should he be a DH, but you can't really DH him if you've got Andrew Vaughn at DH until, you know, Jose Abreu ever drops off. You know, right field's a little bit open. I love the AJ Pollock move for what they got him for. I think AJ's just a professional hitter. I think he fits well. You know, I have less confidence, say, in Adam Engel's bat. But, like, you know, he's a good defender. He can run. He can do some things. Like, so you got kind of that, you know, angle Pollock combination in right. And I think that just kind of keeps it warm until Cespedes and or Colas is ready. Now, the interesting thing would be if Cespedes and Colas are as good as the White Sox hope they're going to be, and Jimenez and Robert are as well, and you have Vaughn and you still have Abreu at first, you know, and they're using Grandal at DH too, you're going to have more guys in spots, you know. But like, I don't think that's going to happen right away because, realistically, Colas needs at least a year in the minors. And they're kind of I know he's at high A right now, and if he tears it up, he might be in double A. But like, I don't think we're going to see Colas this year, and we'll see on Cespedes. I haven't. It was just Arizona Fall League, but you know, I don't know. I'm not quite sure. I think Yoelki Cespedes is as good as the White Sox hope he's going to be. I've talked to a lot of guys who question the bat, and I just wonder about the bat a little bit. So maybe that'll resolve itself, and they won't have an overabundance of talent. But I do think that depth and the number of options they have, and there's only so many spots in the lineup for everybody, did lead to some of that decision making. And I thought getting AJ Pollock was just a great pickup too. So like, I think even for the short term, Pollock and Engel can hold down right field while they wait to see how good the Cubans are.
Jim, when you saw them this spring, did you see Colas in person at all?
I did. I was running around. It was kind of great. It was great because I didn't go to spring training last year because we didn't travel to spring training. And I didn't go to Arizona in 2020. I'd done a little time in Florida before the pandemic. So I did 10 camps in 10 days. But at the same time, because of the lockout schedule, lockout affected our schedule on when stuff came out. I was writing up a bunch of top 30 prospects reports while running around spring training. So it was kind of crazy, but I did do both White Sox camp and Dodgers camp. And I did get backfields games both days. And the day I was doing the Dodgers camp, they were playing the White Sox. White Sox just, you know, walked over from the other side or golf carted over from the other side of Camelback Ranch. So I did see them, and I did, you know, I actually saw Colas, you know, I think I saw him triple, either hit a double or triple the opposite way to left. I mean, it must have been double. I don't think he tripled to left. And then I kind of had half an eye. I was trying to watch two games at once, and I saw him crush a ball when I was at watching my Dodgers day, although they're playing the White Sox. And so I didn't see if it went out, but he pulled a ball. Where I was situated, I couldn't see all the way down the right field line. So I didn't see how far the ball went, but he crushed a ball to right field that I think was a home run. He actually looked pretty good. And he was, you've seen varying reports about his weight. And even like our picture of him from Japan, he looks a little kind of puffy. He was in better condition than some of the photos I'd seen of him in Japan, I thought.
Yeah, I would agree. And I think that's one of the reasons why we had a tough time ranking him. It's just because like we didn't really have the chance to see him prior to doing our list. And I've talked to people that do similar to what you do for other outlets that have seen him that have been impressed. You know, the power has been mostly BP so far, but his numbers have been good. The one thing that's been surprising to me is that they're playing him in center field in Winston-Salem. I don't think anybody thinks he's staying in center field, but you know, I think it's interesting that they're trying it to start out with.
Yeah, I mean, I'm fine with that. I mean, I think he's probably an average runner when all is said and done. And it's weird. Like, I don't know if they have a ground ball staff in Winston-Salem, but he only has 9 putouts and 7 starts, which seems like a very small amount of putouts for center fielder. It's a small sample size, and you know, I don't know if there just haven't been a lot of fly balls, but that seems kind of light. I think they're just kind of seeing what he can do. I mean, it's weird because like, I mean, he was hard to rank because you also get, you try to talk to people who've seen him, and you just get like, you know, like I had guys who were like in Japan, I think at times when he was a little heftier, he was like a below average runner. And then there's people like, oh, he might be a 55 runner. And I kind of settled on 50. And, you know, I think he's probably a 45 to 50 runner when all is said and done. But, it is tough. You know, and that's what I was saying before. Like I know there's some places, like it used to be, not so much now, but I remember, I guess it would have been, 2001, when I was doing the Cubs list of Baseball America, and they just signed Mark Pryor. And Juan Cruz was like one of the hottest pitching prospects in baseball too. And I had people in the Cubs organization tell me that they thought I should rank Juan Cruz ahead of Mark Pryor because I think Cruz had gotten to double A or whatever and Pryor hadn't pitched yet. And I was like, but no, like when you're lining guys up on a list, it's who's going to be better in the long run. So like, even though Mark Pryor hasn't pitched, you guys just gave him $10 million. And it wasn't based on money. Like, you know, Mark Pryor was one of the best pitching prospects I've ever seen. So like but it does make it tough, especially like the difference between say a Mark Pryor and a Colas is at least Pryor we saw at Southern Cal, we saw with Team USA. You had some statistics, even though they're college statistics, you could read into them to some degree. And with Colas, like he barely played. You know, he was more, you know, playing minor league ball in Japan. And then you had the whole Cuban Otani like hype. He barely pitched, but like he was going to be the Cuban Otani for a while, and that calmed down because he's not pitching at all. But it is very hard to rank. It was very hard to rank Cespedes the year before. He wasn't going to be at the top of the list because they still had guys who hadn't graduated to the big leagues like Vaughn and Madrigal. And they had three or four guys. I think Kopech hadn't graduated, right? And Crochet. None of those guys had graduated going into the year. So we weren't going to put Cespedes one. But like with Cespedes, I had very mixed reports on his bat from outside the White Sox system. And so it's like, okay, like, you know, you're not getting a whole lot of consistency on people saying, oh, yeah, I think he can hit 280 and do this, or other guys saying, he might hit 230 and strike out a ton. And it is tough when you don't have a whole lot to go on.
Not to throw a curveball your way, but looking at the top 10 in MLB Pipeline's top 30 prospect list for the Chicago White Sox, only one pitcher is listed, and that's Jorge Vera. We mentioned him briefly.
Well, I snuck Jared Kelly in at number 10, so I got two.
Okay, there you go. So I appreciate you correcting me there. Now, that leads me to my question of, where do you stand related to the way the White Sox are trying to build their pitching staff organizationally? How do you feel about the philosophy that they're going about in the draft in terms of what they want to do in terms of pitching? You know, obviously in the big league club, there's some concerns there, but how do you, in the immediate sense, not seeing a lot in AAA, AA has a handful of names, but where do you stand with the White Sox organizationally related to starting pitching or relief depth?
Yeah, no, I mean, I don't think there's any question that that's something they're trying to address. You know, obviously, if you have to keep buying pitching at the big league level, it gets very expensive. I like their big league rotation. But, you know, there isn't a whole lot of depth if they have, you know, a bunch of injuries crop up. And, you know, I don't disagree with how they've gone about it. I mean, it's funny. Like, I was talking to a guy who's a fan of another team in the AL Central, ironically enough. And we're talking about all the pitchers who've been hurt this year, you know, for the draft. And he's just like, I don't know why, like, anybody would take a pitcher in the top 10. And I was like, well, like, you can't just say that. Like if you have to evaluate the players, and yes, there's more risks with pitchers, but at the same time, if you don't take pitchers with early picks or put money into pitchers, like if you're relying on, hey, we're going to outsmart everybody and draft guys in the fourth round for slot, or like, you're not going to develop a lot of pitching that way either. So, you know, I don't have a problem with how they've gone about it. But I guess that was a long way of saying, like, there are people who think you shouldn't take like high school pitchers in the first round, and they haven't done that. You know, they've invested a lot, obviously, in Matthew Thompson and Andrew Dahlquist and Jared Kelly, and they invested a lot in Jorge Vera on the international market. And, you know, it's tough because I do think the 2020 pandemic really threw off the development of a lot of players, including Thompson and Dahlquist, who, you know, were signed in 19, pitched, you know, what was it, like 5 or 6 innings between them in rookie ball, just cursory token appearances. And then they didn't get a first full minor league season. And that limits how many innings you could give them last year. And they were both really inconsistent. You know, Kelly, I honestly don't know what to make of Jared Kelly. I didn't get to see any of these guys pitch on the backfields because none of them were pitching where I was the days I was there. But Kelly's conditioning was not good. It went south during the pandemic before the White Sox signed him. And his body was not good last year, and he really struggled to throw strikes because of it. And, you know, Thompson, you know, had some injuries, nothing, you know, I think it was a hip flexor. It wasn't an arm, but like he was up and down. You know, Dahlquist, you know, I think his stuff has gotten better, which they hoped, but, you know, this was to be a polished guy, and he couldn't throw strikes at all last year. So, I don't know that those three guys in particular, like, I can make a definitive statement about what the White Sox are doing. And Vera just pitched in the DSL for contract reasons, you know, for tax purposes. So we're just gonna have to see how those guys pan out. I don't think the investments in those guys were bad. I mean, Sean Burke's an interesting one. Sean Burke may actually be a guy. I don't think it's out of the question that Sean Burke could be their best pitching prospect when we do rankings a year from now. But they don't have a lot of depth. You know, they invested in another high school guy last year in Tanner McDougal, but he had Tommy John surgery. So we won't see him till 2023. So, you know, I do think, you know, I don't know that they're necessarily going to target pitching with a bunch of their early picks in this year's draft, but I think they realize that they need more pitching depth. Like, I mean, you guys talked to them too. I mean, they're very well aware of that. You know, again, you know, the guys who were their young pitchers, the Dylan Ceases and the Kopechs and the Giolitos, those guys are up in the big leagues. You know, they do have interesting relievers. You know, Anderson Severino's got an interesting arm. Bennett Souza, you know, has some interesting stuff. You know, they do have some relief options, but, you know, to me, you know, Jimmy Lambert's kind of that up, down, back of the rotation, fill in type of guy. They don't really have a guy right now, I don't think, that you can look at and say, okay, in 2023, by mid 2023, here's the guy we're going to plug into the rotation. They just don't have that guy right now.
I'm really glad you brought up Sean Burke. That's an advanced arm, you know, college right-hander, tall, lanky. He's got great stuff, throws hard. So that's somebody that we're keeping an eye on here at Future Sox. So thanks for bringing him up. And if I could switch gears a little bit, sure, to your opinion of just in the White Sox system overall, is there anybody close to breaking MLB's top 100?
Yeah, I mean, I think Colson Montgomery could. You know, and it's like, and our list is kind of fluid because we graduate guys. You know, like once a guy loses his rookie status, like Jake Berger, I guess. I don't know how many major league days he's at right now. But once he spends his 45 days? Yeah, once he spends his 46th day on an active roster, not that Jake Berger's on our top 100, but Jake Berger's on our White Sox list, boom, Jake Berger's gone and we replace him. So, I mean, I think if Colson, you know, continues to hit for average and control the strike zone like he has, and, you know, starts, you know, the power starts to manifest itself in some, you know, some home runs and not just all doubles, he's a guy. And I also think, again, it's early, but, you know, Colas, if Colas comes out and, I mean, he's played, what, 7 games, so it's like I'm not going to read too much. He's off to a good start in high A. But, like, if Oscar Colas, let's say he hits 300 and he hits 15 homers in half a season, you know, then I think, you know, at midseason we'd be like, hey, we might have to think about this guy for the top 100. So I think those two guys, and then I think the sneaky guy, although, you know, it's not loud tools where he's going to hit, I think, you know, 25 home runs or anything like that. But like Jose Rodriguez is pretty sneaky good. He kind of fits that profile of the guy who winds up being a pretty good big leaguer. And you're like, hey, nobody ever put this guy on a top 100 list. But I mean, he does. I don't think he has a below average tool, and he can hit, and he's moved real quick for his age. He's already in Double A at age 20. He's just a sneaky good player. And so, you know, I mean, depending on how the list looks, if we have a bunch of graduations, I wouldn't rule him out either. Like I think like I said, he might be one of those guys who gets to the big leagues and a different type of player. But Jeremy Pena was that way. And I know he's on some top 100 list, but we haven't ever ranked Jeremy Pena on our top 100. And I think Jose Rodriguez could kind of be one of those guys who gets to the big leagues as a pretty good player who never makes it.
Yeah, Jim, another guy that I've always thought was interesting is Brian Ramos, just because of like how young he's like always been. He's 20 now. He's going to play the whole year at 20 at Winston. He's been off to a really good start too, like, you know, hitting for power, but he doesn't really walk much. And I think it's probably important for him to stay at least at third, right? Because if he ends up at first, I mean, he's going to have to really hit. But I've always like kind of thought he was interesting too.
I do too. Like he's always hit. He's always been young for his age. You know, last year he only hit 244, but that was coming off the pandemic. He was 19 years old in low A, and he had a shoulder injury, that bothered him. I had a DH, I think, a lot of the first half. I think he's got really good bat on ball skills. You know, he walked okay last year. He doesn't walk a ton, but he's not, you know, I think he's one of those guys who's going to walk roughly 10% of his plate appearances. So it's not going to be a high walk guy, but I think it'll be enough. Like to me, you know, his ceiling would be a guy who could hit like 280, you know, maybe get you, you know, 15, 20 home runs. draw a decent amount of walks. And like you said, I think the trickiest thing when evaluating prospects is figuring out what position they're going to play. Because, I mean, like you just said, if Ramos can stay at third, that's a lot more value than if he's at first. Because I don't know that he quite has that. He might get there, but I don't know that he quite has enough offense that like you're looking for from your first baseman. But he would be good offensively at third base. And he's okay. He's not super quick, but he's got pretty good hands. He's got okay range. I mean, they've even played him at second some. I don't know that I think he's really quick enough to play second. You know, he might be one of the more of those like shift second basemen, you know, where he could get away with it. But I like him. And I think just because he's been so young and, you know, he played rookie ball and then he lost a year to the pandemic and he didn't put up loud numbers, but a 760 ops for a 19-year-old in low A while he's hurt is pretty good. Like the secondary numbers were pretty good. So I think he's flown under the radar and, you know, like I have him. Like, I mean, I have a million infielders. Like I have Montgomery, Rodriguez, Kath, Berger, Romy Gonzalez, and Brian Ramos. So I have him as the sixth best infielder in the system. But like, if you told me he jumped up, like if you told me Brian Ramos was, you know, in their top five prospects at the end of the season, I think that's very possible too. I think that's a good call. I think he just hasn't put up like huge numbers or been that high up in the minors, but I think he's very quietly one of the better hitters in their system.
One guy you mentioned was Jake Berger. I know you've always been a fan. We've loved that story. He's in the big leagues right now because Yoan Moncada's not there. I guess like it's probably true that what's good for the White Sox ultimately won't end up being good for Jake Berger because there's just not a spot. Like they have more bats than spots. Obviously, you know, it's good to have depth and he could fill in. But I mean, is his best course maybe being somewhere else? And do you think that other teams are interested in Jake Berger? He looks like a guy that could hit at least lefties probably in the big leagues.
Yeah. I mean, I think all that's fair. Like I've always, anybody's ever talked to me, I just have a lot of respect for the Missouri State program. I mean, I've covered this stuff for years. I used to be the college guy when I started off at Baseball America 30 something years ago, and Missouri State just always has a good program and they produce a ton of big leaguers and you just don't hear much about them. And, you know, Berger, you know, tremendous story. I mean, a couple serious Achilles injuries and then a heel injury. And he basically didn't play for 3 years unless the Carr Shield Collegiate League? Like he got a little time in during the pandemic. And then he came back and he was kind of Jake Berger all over again, which is pretty amazing considering he lost 3 years of at-bats. And yeah, I mean, I think he is stuck because, you know, he's not going to play ahead of Moncada at the big league level. I do think he's, you know, for a guy who's 6'2", 230, I'm not saying he's a great athlete, but like, I think he's like sneakily athletic. Like, I think he can run close to average and I think he can, you know, play a pretty decent third base. You know, the problem is too, it's like, yes, he would have like, he's not going to probably play a lot for the White Sox unless, you know, injuries, you know, open the door for him. But at the same time, he's already 26. He hits right-handed. There's not a ton of position versatility. So I don't know that you're going to get a ton in trade for him. Like the interesting thing, and like we were just talking about Brian Ramos. Like I know Berger's played some second base. That's probably a stretch at the big league level. You know, maybe with shifting and positioning. You know, I've always seen Leury Garcia, to me personally, as more of a utility guy than a guy I would play every day. That's just what I think he is. I think he's better that way. But Leury Garcia is a lot better defensively than Jake Berger is at second. So you'd have to get Jake, you know, Jake would have to really outproduce him, I think, by a lot. So I'm happy for Jake. It was cool seeing him hit the home run the other night. He is a little bit blocked. He needs to hope he keeps hitting, you know, 375 and then he could be this year's Yermin Mercedes and La Russa will have to keep him in the lineup or something. But even if he keeps doing this, you're not, when Moncada is going to come back, say, well, okay, Yoan, you got to wait till Jake cools off. But yeah, I do think there are teams he could start on, but I don't think that the White Sox are necessarily one of them. And like we were talking about with Andrew Vaughn and the outfielders, like there aren't really even that many at-bats at DH, especially because I think they're trying to maximize the offensive production they're getting out of Yasmani Grandal by not wearing him down at catcher. And so like that leaves fewer at-bats for DH for somebody.
So the last thing I have for you, you know, we talked about merging with Sox Machine. Me and Josh Nelson published our first mock draft of the year last week. Projected.
Was it just
the
for the White Sox, or was it for
no?
All...
We did the whole first round.
But, oh, nice.
But we did separate picks for the White Sox, and you know, I went with Justin Crawford, Carl Crawford's son, obviously you know well, and then Josh went Gabriel Hughes, the righty from Gonzaga. Do those make sense in that area? Obviously, that's one demo. You know, it's a high school position player. College pitching seems like the most likely demographic, but who knows? It's early.
Yeah, I mean, well, I would definitely agree with you guys, and I would bet on a hitter. Well, I mean, here's the thing. I don't know if Gabriel Hughes is going to get there because the college pitching has just been devastated by injuries this year. Like we had Gabriel Hughes, and he'll be higher. We're working on a new list, a new top 150. But Gabriel Hughes was number 41 on our top 100 coming into the year. There's no college pitcher ahead of him who's healthy and pitching in a weekend rotation right now. And there's only one who's healthy and pitching, and that's Blade Tidwell, who was hurt and came back. But Tennessee's weekend rotation until like this week has been great. So they've just been easing him back like in midweek games, a little bit of relief action. And then Carson Wisenant's not hurt, but he's suspended for the whole year. And then there's a ton of guys who are hurt. So Gabriel Hughes would be a nice pick for them because as we talked about, they need nice pitching, but I just think that somebody's going to want a college pitcher before 26. And I think he's the first one taken. So I think it's less likely that Hughes gets to them, and just the nature of this whole draft, I think it's probably more likely that that it winds up being a hitter because teams don't like to take high school pitchers high. There might be some good high school pitchers. You know, there's Andrew Dukanich in Indiana. There's Brock Porter in Michigan. And those are typically guys who they're good, but teams try to take them with their second pick. And maybe there'd be some value. And we know Mike Shirley loves his Indiana guys, so maybe we should just give him Andrew Dukanich. But no, Justin Crawford's a good one too. Like you noted, he's Carl Crawford's son, super athletic. You know, he's having a good year. I think he probably goes in that 20 to 40, 25 to 45 range right now. So I could definitely see that too. I will do a mock draft in a couple weeks. I haven't started on it yet. So, I don't have a White Sox pick, per se. But if I was forced at gunpoint right now to pick a pick for the White Sox at 26, without having any idea what they're thinking or who they're like, I'm just going to give them Andrew Dukanich because I'm going to take the cop out and I'll just keep giving Mike Shirley players from Indiana in the early rounds. So I'll go Andrew Dukanich, although I don't necessarily that's just me being a little silly. But, yeah, it's tough. And I will say this, like even trying to line up our top 150 right now, my first, you know, 15 or 20 names on that list that Jonathan Mayo and I are putting together, I feel pretty good about the first 15 or 25 names. And then it's a mess. We've sent out our 21 to 40 to a bunch of directors and cross checkers for feedback. And I'm already second guessing how we have the guys from 21 to 40 lined up. So, it's going to be very, very interesting. You know, thank God we have 3 weeks to figure this out. I mean, 3 weeks, 3 months, the draft's so far away because it is just very, very confusing right now.
Jim, outstanding stuff. It's April. Baseball's back. We're talking to Jim Callis about prospects in the draft. All things are right in the world. Hey, are the White Sox winning the World Series this year or what?
You know, it's funny. So we picked I think I picked the Dodgers, but I had the Dodgers beating the White Sox. I was trying to think, I was trying to think back way to make our picks for MLB. I did have the White Sox winning the American League pennant. I did have them losing to the Dodgers, although picking the Dodgers is almost, I mean, not that they're a lock, but like on paper, they're just the best team. So like, I don't know how exciting that was. I had a reprise of the 1959 World Series, but I do like this White Sox team a lot. And I think they could. Are you, I mean, I know you guys are obviously biased, but you guys must feel pretty good about the White Sox, right?
Yeah, I'd like to see them add a quality starter at some point before the deadline, and I'll feel better, and hopefully they stay healthy. James, what do you think?
Yeah, they got a shot. I mean, I'm the big, the regular season determines the best team, and the playoffs determine, like, the winner of the tournament. So, exactly. you got to win your division a bunch and get in, and hopefully, it's a lot of variance, and I'm that guy. So people are annoyed mm-hmm. by me because
I don't like
picking the playoffs because I don't know.
James, that's perfectly fair, and I agree with that. And it's funny because like you can't really say that like if you go on radio shows and talk about how the playoffs are basically a crapshoot, but like that's essentially what it is. And like so you're gonna play 162 games, like you said. I mean, win the division and get a bye. That's the only thing that matters. And then it's just who gets hot for 3 weeks. The best team doesn't always win. And like the nice thing is, I mean, I cannot see any way the White Sox don't get into the playoffs. Like, I mean, I guess they could have just an unbelievable amount of injuries, but just if you look at how talented they are, A, compared to the rest of their division, and B, I can't envision a scenario where they wouldn't get one of the three wild cards at worst.
There it is. There you have it. Jim Callis. Thank you so much.
Yeah, hey, great talking to you guys.
That was Jim Callis, senior writer for MLB Pipeline. Does a lot of prospect work, as you could tell, from MajorLeagueBaseball.com. That was a fun interview, James. There's a lot to take away from there, and we can go over it quickly. Some of the things he was highlighting regarding the outfielders was fascinating. He didn't dismiss the fact that Cespedes could be a Major League outfielder, but a little bit of concern. Maybe we got to dial back our expectations for him specifically. He was pretty high on Oscar Colas. I think the question you asked him was really interesting, like regarding, what he could turn into and potentially be a top 100 prospect. But the Jose Rodriguez bite, give me more of that. I mean, he's very high on Jose Rodriguez.
Yeah, and I think they have him third, right? Which is as high as anybody has him, which is interesting. I mean, he scuffled a little bit early here in Double A, which, it's Double A, it's hard. And he doubled twice last night, which would have been Friday night. He had two doubles. So, but the thing is, if he turns it around with the Barons, Jose Rodriguez could be in the big leagues like pretty soon. Like he mentioned next year. I mean, he could be their second baseman next year. I mean, he could be, because if you hit it Double A, you're a real prospect. So, yeah, that's interesting. So the Colas stuff is fascinating to me just because like I'm eating up anything from anyone that's actually seen him. It's very hard. It was very hard to rank him, and we talked about that, and even people that have access to more people than we do had a tough time ranking him. But there's been writers from Baseball America, writers from Baseball Prospectus that have seen him. Scouts have been to Winston because that team's interesting, and it's just prodigious left-handed power, like in BP mostly, but then in games, he's kind of been taking what the other team has given him. And, Colas is hitting 321, 406, 429 early on. He's walking over 12%. He's only striking out 15% of the time. I don't know how long he's going to stay in Winston. You would think the power is going to come, but, if he goes to Birmingham and does similar, I think he's a top 100 guy, like pretty soon.
Yeah, that's really good stuff, too. I mean, he was transparent about Jared Kelly as well, James, talking about his conditioning. I mean, there's a lot there. And to Kelly's credit, he's going to start this year, and it's going to be a big year. He wants to prove the organization, prove to himself that he belongs as a highly touted prospect. Obviously, we're just saying this out loud, not speaking to him. But of course, as a competitor, this is what he has to do. He has to have success if he wants to compete at a high level, as we expect him to do ultimately. Any other things that you took away from the conversation we just had with Jim Callis here, James?
I think the Colson stuff was expected. Colson, I think we wrestled with other guys, right? Jorge Vera, and some of us liked Wes Kath, and Cespedes is obviously clearly has his issues. But I mean, Colson Montgomery's the number one prospect in this system for a reason. Yes, he's 20, so he's a little bit more advanced. We had that conversation last year, but he's in low A, first season, in full season affiliated baseball with a 460 on base percentage down there. So he's not hitting for a ton of power, but he's walking, you know, which portends very well for the future. I think he's got three or four doubles already. You know, he's striking out a lot, but I don't really care about that because the walks are coming too. I mean, it's a 154 weighted runs created plus early on in Kannapolis in his debut. So that's, you know, that's been impressive. Jim didn't talk about this much, but the whole Kannapolis team is like insane to me, the turnaround. Like they're, you know, leading the what is now the Carolina League in offense, which is a far cry from what the discussions that we were having on this podcast last year.
You can check out our last podcast as James goes in depth about that specific topic on the Blue Wire Network. We are now partners with Sox Machine and also available on every podcasting platform that you could think of. So please subscribe to the Future Sox podcast and continue to follow us on futuresox.com. That is, again, now part of soxmachine.com. Go to our Twitter, at Future Sox, to keep an eye on everything. That's our main hub of providing information, posting content. You'll see updates daily regarding the minor league affiliates, as well as updates on players that we're featuring. And you can see our content creators, at JamesFox917 on Twitter, share his thoughts as well. I'm at Rankin906. Again, think about becoming a Patreon. It really does help us out. It continues to allow us to grow, and it's paid dividends in the end, and we want to thank you specifically, the supporter of us at Future Sox. Think about becoming a Patreon. Go to SoxMachine.com to sign up there if you wish. For James Fox, my name's Mike Rankin. Take us into consideration as your weekly routine on Tuesdays. We will post our podcast every Tuesday morning, so look forward to that. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week.